Nearly 4 years in the making, Return from ISIS tells the story of an American mother and her children's journey from Indiana to the heart of the self-declared ISIS caliphate and back. Throughout the documentary, Samantha El-Hassani claims she was tricked into taking her children to Syria by her husband. But where her account ends and the truth begins is a gray area. Director, writer, and producer Josh Baker uncovers the lasting consequences for Sam and her family in Return from ISIS, and it premieres tonight on Frontline at STPB-TV at 9 Central, 8 Mountain. You can listen to the accompanying podcast, I'm Not a Monster, which is in collaboration with BBC Sounds and BBC Panorama on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Josh Baker joins us via Zoom now from the UK. Josh, welcome to The Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me. And please don't worry about the conversation. The panorama is a difficult thing to say.
I think I'm rushing past some of the details because this is such a compelling story, but it is important for people to know where to find the podcast. You know, I almost had a hard time stepping out of, you know, my headspace of the pandemic to sit in this space and go, wait a minute, these compelling stories have been happening in the world, and now I'm transitioning to, you know, something outside of this one thing. And it brought a lot of stuff rushing in for me, and I think it will for other viewers and listeners to the podcast and to this show. You live in this space very closely, and I want to start with this moment where you first hear the story of Sam El-Hassani. You got a fractured spine, you have shrapnel in your head, you have been in this moment where most people would be like, I think I need to find a different job. You hear her story and you say, I want to know more. Take me to that to that moment where I'm a little worried about you as a human being, Josh. But tell us about when you first heard about her story.
So essentially, I had been making another film for Frontline about the battle for an Iraqi city called Mosul. Essentially, I was with Iraqi special forces. They were trying to retake this city from ISIS. And fortunately, while I was there, I was hit by an ISIS suicide bombing. And I ended up with shrapnel in my head, as you say, and a fractured spine. Luckily, unlike other people who were there, I was able to make it home to the UK. Now, while in recovery in London, an old contact of mine who I'd kind of lost touch with reached out to me to see if I was okay. And we went for a cup of tea, we were chatting away, and he casually mentions this American family that he's heard about who are trapped in the ISIS capital of Raqqa in Syria. And they're desperately looking for a way out. And I was sort of like, hold on a minute, back up. What do you mean there's an American family trapped with ISIS? And then from there, I spent about 4 years slowly unraveling how this family had gone from South Bend, Indiana, and ended up in the heart of the ISIS caliphate, what had happened to them when they were there, and sort of what happens now that they've come home. And as you said earlier, it's told as a one-hour special for Frontline and a 10-part podcast as well called I'm Not a Monster.
And the Frontline is remarkable. I also want to just give a particular, shout out for the podcast for listeners to say having the time over a 10-part listening experience to unfold this story. I do not know how you got some of that tape to start with. And I want to focus on the story of Sam, but I also, if you will just indulge me in spending another minute with you and the work that you did, this is incredible footage that you get, and you put yourself at great risk to get it. Tell me a little bit about your journey, if you don't mind.
Not at all. I mean, thank you very much. I mean, this story, actually, even in the film and less so in the podcast, but still to some degree, we only show a fraction of the people we spoke to around this family's journey. I mean, we literally speak to neighbors they had in Raqqa, members of ISIS that knew them, family members, childhood friends. And we build this picture of the entire family dynamic before they left and what it was like when they were with ISIS. And then, as you say, we were able to get hold of some footage, which very sadly show Matthew, which is Sam Sally's oldest son, being forced to assemble a suicide bomb by his stepfather. And Matthew would later as well appear in a ISIS propaganda film, which was broadcast around the world, where he was again forced against his will to threaten President Trump. So I was confronted in the first video by this young boy who was essentially being put in the position of potentially in the future having to carry out an attack. Thankfully, that never happened. And also having just survived a suicide bombing myself. So I felt this incredible urge to try and find this boy and find out what was going on here. And that's sort of what motivated the four-year journey, to be honest with you.
Thank you for sharing that. Let's talk a little bit about Sam and who she is. You learn a little bit about who she was before she marries this man who she will follow to Syria. She is a risk taker. She is described as being somewhat of a manipulator, but she's also just a normal, American teenager at some point. Tell us a little bit about her background.
Yeah, as you say, she's not what you imagine when people think about those who end up with ISIS. She, in Indiana, in South Bend, Indiana, where the family lived before they left America, they seemed to have a relatively comfortable life. You know, they had a lot of cash, they drove nice cars, they had motorbikes, they had a relatively big house and a family business that they could work in. And somewhere along the way, it appears that Musa, Sam's husband, became radicalized. So he started to support ISIS and started planning to leave the country. And one of the things we spend a while unraveling in the podcast and in the film is when Sam knew that Musa wanted to join ISIS and what she did or did not do to support him in that endeavor. And as you say, Sam ended up going from this comfortable life in America to the heart of the Islamic State Caliphate. I mean, they ended up in Raqqa, which was the group's self-declared capital city, and they lived there for more than 2 years, enduring unimaginable horror. And we sort of piece by piece put together what happened to them there.
Mm-hmm. Including torture. And tell us a little bit about Sam tells you in these interviews that she was tortured, that she was held in custody. But you need to try to find out if that's true, because some of the things that she tell you, there are holes in her story. And you go to this football stadium and you try to talk to people and piece the story together. What do you find regarding interrogation and torture and what you know about what happened to Sam?
I mean, you're right. As you say, when I first found Sam in Syria in December of 2017, I did this interview with her. But this interview was heavily monitored by the militia that were holding her. So it was very difficult to sort of go outside a certain parameter of conversation. So everything she was telling me at the time, I was trying to think, how do I fact check this? How do I find out if she's telling me the truth? And one of the things she claimed was that she was tortured. She also told me various things about her life with ISIS. So we ended up going to Raqqa twice, just after it had been liberated the first time and a little later on the second time. And while there, we were sort of confronted by this city, a whole city that is literally in ruins. More than 11,000 buildings were obliterated in the fighting to remove ISIS from that city. So it's a city of rubble. And it's also very dangerous. There are still ISIS elements there. There are what we call IEDs, the improvised explosive devices. So it's booby traps, essentially. So it's a very difficult place to operate. But we sort of navigated our way around the city, finding homes that Sam had lived in previously, finding places that we knew Matthew had been forced to make videos, or places that we'd seen pictures of them hanging out. And one of the places we came to was indeed a football stadium that was known as the Black Stadium locally. And ISIS converted the changing rooms of this stadium into essentially a torture facility. And people would be sent there for things as little as smoking, or if women were to show certain patches of skin, perhaps they'd show their glove, their hand in public, removing a glove, you could end up there. It was a very strict regime under ISIS, a barbaric regime. And then also at the other end of the spectrum, there were people there who tried to escape ISIS, or perhaps were being suspected of being spies for the American government. And Sam gave quite a detailed account that I won't go into too much now of what she suffered there, where she was held. So my colleague and I sort of set about finding this facility where she said she was held and doing whatever we could to slowly piece together the room that she said she was claimed she was held in, the methods of torture that she went through, and look for any evidence of this and piece together whether her story was true. We also found other ISIS members who knew her within her time with ISIS, and one of them claimed to have been held in the room next to Sam and witnessed what happened to her.
The people that you're talking to, you interview Matthew, and he tells his story. He's now safe, living with his biological father. You interview Sam, and it has to be incredibly frustrating for you to know that you're not hearing the whole story, trying to figure out what, how these people have been damaged by the experience that they have, and also what someone like Sam is simply not telling you from a self-protective standpoint. What's the truth? What's not? But you have talked to people like this before. You've been through your own life situations. What is it like to sit with these people, hear their story, hear them talk around some of the more horrific parts of it, and record it in a way that is responsible, revealing, and also does no damage to someone like Matthew, who is also trying to move on with his life?
Yeah, I mean, each interview is its own unique experience. I've done interviews in the past with survivors of sexual violence, which I find very difficult personally to deal with. But you have a sort of methodology that you put in place to ensure that that interview is safe for both them and for me. And for Matthew in particular, you know, I first met Matthew in December 2017, and we didn't do any on-camera interview with him until a couple of months ago, so 2020. And the process of doing that was basically one that, to be honest with you, we built up over years. And before we went anywhere near interviewing Matthew, we knew that he had gone through extensive therapy, extensive help to reintegrate into American society. We knew that he was back in a loving home with his father. We spent a long time talking with his dad and with Matthew about everything that we were doing in the film and the podcast, to see whether they were happy with what we were doing, how he was going to be represented. And then we left them to it to think about whether they wanted to be part of that. And then what happened is we conducted a very short chat with Matthew and I on camera, and then later a much, much longer one. And I have to say, just for me, the first time I got to see Matthew back in the US, because I made a couple of visits to him as well before ever filming with him, it was just this incredible joy, because you have to realize the first time I saw this boy, he was an incredibly vulnerable position. He was in ISIS territory. He was being forced to do something he didn't want to. And then I saw him in Syria. And then to see him back in America with his dad skateboarding like a normal kid and having a shot at living in a normal life was the most wonderful experience you can hope for. As a journalist, we get to step in and out of people's realities. And this time I got to see something incredible that had a sort of happy ending to it. And what became clear that first time I met Matthew was that there were things about his life in Raqqa he felt comfortable telling me about. I don't know if that's because he knew I met him in Syria, so he knew I had some understanding of little things that he'd been through. And he sort of started to open up to me. So by the time I came to interview him properly, Matthew and I had got to know each other relatively well, and he was very comfortable with me. And what was really nice about the way that we did that interview, there are times, and we weren't afraid of including them in the film so people could honestly see for themselves, but there were times where I asked Matthew things and he didn't want to talk about it. And that for me was actually a really positive thing, because it truly showed that he felt he was in control of that conversation. And ultimately, what we wanted to do was give Matthew a platform to sort of reclaim his narrative, because this was a boy that was broadcast around the world as, you know, an ISIS mouthpiece. And actually, he's not that. He's a normal 13-year-old kid who's just been through a very horrific experience and is now reclaiming his life.
I want to make sure to tell people that Frontline is on SDPB TV at 9 Central, 8 Mountain tonight. The program is called Return from ISIS, and there is also this podcast that accompanies it called I Am Not a Monster. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, BBC Sounds, and BBC Panorama. Josh Baker, this is an incredible project. There's so much more I want to ask you about this and about your work, but we'll direct people to the work itself and they can see it there. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, you too.